Welcome to the Sky Pilot Podcast that explores questions of faith, spirituality, and religion. I'm Dan Matthews, and I don't have all the answers, but I do enjoy the questions. Welcome to the podcast where every question is an invitation into a spiritual quest, and you're invited along for the journey. Which denomination is best? As my wife says I'm apt to do on most subjects, I'm going to start in a seemingly unrelated place, but it relates to the subject, I promise. All of us have probably heard these terms, introvert, extrovert, but surprisingly, the majority of people don't really know what those words truly mean. We think that extroverts are gregarious and outgoing, and introverts are reclusive and shy, but that's not quite correct. The true definition of these two personality traits has nothing to do with behavior. It has to do with where you get energized, or as I prefer to say, it has to do with where your batteries get recharged. My wife Sarah and I learned of these two definitions shortly after we were married. We would occasionally have a party at our place, and we'd invite over a group of friends, and the gathering would always be a lot of fun, and sometimes go into the early hours of the morning. When the last of our guests left, we would straighten up our place, and as we were doing so, I would begin to float the idea with Sarah that we should do this again, soon, tomorrow even. Being an extrovert, the time I just spent around people I really enjoyed left me energized. I was stimulated to the point of feeling like I'd had several cups of coffee. Sarah, on the other hand, had experienced an equally wonderful and fun time with our friends, but as an introvert was thoroughly exhausted. She'd really enjoyed herself, but the socializing had left her depleted. She needed some time to recharge her emotional batteries by being alone. This relates to a similar learning I discovered about myself in graduate school. One day, in the middle of my first year of seminary, it was announced that next week we would have a quiet day. Classes would be canceled. We'd have a speaker for a very brief time in the morning, but mostly the day would be marked by silence. We were encouraged not to speak for the entire day. We would all be on campus in silent retreat together. Now, it's been said of extroverts that we don't even know if we have an idea until we have someone else to speak it aloud to. And I would say there is, at least for me, a lot of truth to this. Talking is the way I process and think. Even when writing sermons, after I have something that I think might work written down on paper, I take it into an empty church and say it out loud, pretending the room is filled with people. Now, it's not the same as speaking to someone, but at least talking aloud while pretending someone is there seems to help the process. It is amazing how limiting it is for me to be told I may not speak for the entire day. I don't experience it in any way as spiritual. I find it suffocating and limiting. So during these quiet days in seminary, I fell into a pattern. I would go back to my room and read for a while, and then I'd get a little antsy, and I'd go for a walk on campus, quickly forgetting, of course, that it was quiet day, and then forgetfully giving a hearty hello to a fellow student who was also out walking on campus. I remember clearly how small I felt when the person I said hello to would give me a stern and disapproving glare as they put a silent finger up to their lips. So back to denominations. Where did these denominations come from? The first major split in the Christian church occurred in 1054, but in reality, that's just the date we say it officially happened. Long before that date, the Christian church was technically unified as one church, but there was an Eastern branch with its own leader, who was the Ecumenical Patriarch, was his title, and a Western branch with its own leader, who was the Pope, who was technically over all of the church, but they ran pretty separately. Their worship services looked different. The language of the services were different. Not only were the churches in the East and West separated by geography, they also had a few churches in each other's territory. And around this time, trouble was brewing on both sides. The Pope, officially head of both sides, but committed to the Western church's ways, issued an edict to all of the Eastern churches that happened to be in Italy, telling them that from henceforth they must follow the ways of the Western Church or close their doors forever. On the other side, the leader of the Eastern Church, the Patriarch, didn't like the Western or Latin Church, as it's often known, didn't like the fact that it used unleavened bread for communion, whereas the Eastern Church used leavened bread. Ultimately, the Pope sent a delegation to the East to address several issues, which mostly turned out to be ultimatums. First was, of course, the bread issue. And then the delegation from the Pope also insisted that the Eastern leader acknowledge the supremacy of the Pope's leadership over all of the Church. And they also informed the Eastern Church leader that the Pope was stripping him of the title Ecumenical Patriarch. This meeting was an utter disaster and ended with both sides excommunicating each other. Now, excommunicating technically means you refuse the bread and the wine in communion, but it amounts to being kicked out of church. And so, in 1054, we have the official split between the Greek Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, the birth of the first denominations. Now, let's fast forward 500 years to 1517. There was a little-known professor in the University of Wittenberg in Germany. He was going through a spiritual awakening in his life, much of which came from a new interpretation he had come to while reading the book of Romans in the New Testament. This professor was named Martin Luther, and in response to this discovery and what he saw going on around him, he wrote 95 Theses. Think of them as 95 topics for debate. He took them and nailed them to the door of the church in Wittenberg. Now, although the 95 Theses are seen as the beginning of the Reformation, the act of nailing them to the church door was not quite as revolutionary a gesture as it sounds. This was not a sign of Luther being bold or attacking the church. The door of the church was often used as a community bulletin board. This was the natural place to tack up these theses if he wanted to invite discussion. Now, the 95 Theses, which were intended to spark a formal academic debate, instead of sparked a theological revolution across Europe. At the time of Luther, Pope Leo X was trying to finish St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, and he needed a lot of money because it was an expensive project. So in order to raise funds, he approved the sale of indulgences. Now, indulgences are really much larger subject, but in this case, what it means is selling the forgiveness of sins. You could pay money to the church to have the sins of a deceased relative forgiven. This mattered because of the Catholic Church's belief in purgatory. Now, think of there being heaven and hell, and then kind of halfway between there is purgatory, a place where people were destined to spend time until they had worked off enough sins that they were released and allowed to go to heaven. So the purchase of indulgences could, according to those who sold them, get the sins of a loved one forgiven. The purchase would shorten or even eliminate their time in purgatory. There were even cases of people buying indulgences in advance, buying the church's forgiveness for things they had not yet done but they knew were sinful and were planning to do. Luther looked at this and saw all sorts of problems with this system, from the idea of purgatory to the notion that the church could sell forgiveness. Now, there were many people other than Luther who contributed to the Protestant Reformation. Wycliffe, Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, and others were all major forces. Some even predated Luther, but generally, his 95 Theses are seen as the tipping point in which this movement really gained momentum. Interestingly, Luther, in the beginning, didn't even intend to break free of the Catholic Church and start a new church. He honestly thought a discussion of the issues he had raised would cause the church to reform from within. Luther didn't want to start a new denomination. He wanted to start a reformation of the Catholic Church, but ultimately felt pushed out of a church, unwilling to entertain change. Now, other Reformation leaders were so distressed by the things they disagreed with in the Catholic Church, they weren't looking for change from within. They felt from the very beginning they had no option but to leave the church and start something new. And more denominations were born. Now, I should have said probably from the top, but allow me to make an aside for a moment. As I speak about denominations within Christianity, it's tempting to listen with an ear tuned to discern who is right and who is wrong. And I don't want anything to do with that judgmental process. I think the sale of indulgences was wrong, of course, as would almost all Catholic clergy and scholars who I've had the privilege to know. You know the analogy of the frog in hot water? And I don't know if it's true, but it's useful as a teaching tool. According to lore, if you drop a frog into boiling water, it will know immediately to jump out because it's in danger. But if you place the frog into comfortable water and then slowly raise the temperature to the boiling point, it will never notice the change and stay in the water without ever trying to get out. The analogy works for many of the situations in which churches go astray. There are plenty of examples in every denomination of times the denomination has strayed and becomes something theologically wrong. Most often, not because anyone decided to make a bad decision, but because a series of small decisions, most of them seemingly inconsequential at the time, have a cumulative effect of leading somewhere that is later determined to be a mistake. This is not just true of that moment in time for the Catholic Church. It's true for every denomination and every faith, the best I can tell, including my own faith, Christianity, and my own denomination, the Episcopal Church. So before we proceed further, let us agree to open ourselves to the possibility of learning in this moment and resist the urge to pull out the bony finger of judgment and point it at other people. And I'm pretty sure there's even something in the Bible said by Jesus about challenging anyone who wants to throw a stone of judgment. I think he said, make sure you are without sin before you throw it. Now back to the arguments that led to the Great Reformation. All of this background helps make a point. Every split in the church that I can think of has come about by disagreement. I'm not aware of an instance in which a denomination had everyone getting along and then suddenly decided to split into two different groups. The only times I'm aware of a split are because of conflict. Now, my own denomination, the Episcopal Church, is an offshoot of the Church of England, which broke with the Catholic Church around the time of the Reformation. But interestingly, the break of the English Church from the Catholic Church was initially more political than it was theologically motivated. Henry VIII was an outspoken opponent, actually, of the Reformation, but split from the Catholic Church in order to secure a male heir. It was believed that England could not be successfully run by a female, by a queen, and ironically, after Henry and a bit of upheaval through two heirs, Edward and Mary, his heir Elizabeth, who is a female, if you can't tell by the name, came to the throne and saw a very long and successful reign. Also, under Elizabeth, the English Church followed much of the Protestant Reformation theologically while keeping much of the worship feel of the Catholic Church. Okay, now for what I think is a really fascinating story. My wife and I discovered this when we were on a trip to the Holy Land one time. Arguably, the holiest city in the world for Christians is Jerusalem, and the holiest site in the world is found in Jerusalem. It is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Now, the word sepulchre just means a tomb or burial site carved into a rock. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre is a large building in Jerusalem where under one roof is contained both the traditional sites of Jesus' crucifixion and also his tomb. The church, which isn't like any church you've ever visited, is jointly overseen by three Christian denominations: Greek Orthodox, Armenian, and Catholic. What is worth noting is that the tension runs high amongst these three, each fiercely ensuring they get as much time and claim to the building as the other two. Matter of fact, the story goes that in ancient history, when Jerusalem was under Muslim control, the Muslim leader got so tired of dealing with denominational squabbles at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, he took away the keys to the church and gave them to a Muslim family who was entrusted with the job of opening and closing the doors each day. Fast forward to now, 800 years later, it is still a Muslim family who keeps the keys to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in order to keep peace amongst these Christian groups. So it seems pretty clear, if most denominations began with a fight, and long after we have denominations, we continue to fight, and God longs for us to be unified, then the different denominations must be a mistake, right? Well, I'm not actually willing to go quite that far. Let me put it this way. Racism is wrong, but it would be a mistake to say, therefore, race is wrong. The cultural and racial differences between us are a wonderful reminder of the creativity and diversity to be found in God's creation. Racism, on the other hand, is how people take something that was good and use it in evil and destructive ways. There's an overlap between these two subjects because some of our denominationalism and even religionism across the globe has been nothing more than thinly veiled racism throughout the years. Remember that our differences are not the problem. It's our attitude towards others who are religiously, culturally, ethnically, or racially different from us which can be the problem. I don't think denominations are evil or wrong per se. At their best, they're simply different ways in which we seek and serve God. I told the opening story about myself and my extroverted difficulty with quiet days because I think it's not surprising that I am a clergy person in a denomination that has a lot of talking. Matter of fact, we try to arrange this worship service so it feels a bit like a conversation. In other words, everyone gets to talk. And for me, that's comfortable. Quaker services, on the other hand, are often filled with lots of silences, and I have enormous respect for Quakers, and even I'm a little envious, wishing I were more comfortable with long periods of silence. The worship, which makes me feel close to God, is not better than the ways of the Quakers. It's just different. And our differences are not just okay. I think it's good, as long as there's mutual respect. Some of us like silence. Some of us like spoken word. Some like organ music, and others like guitars and drums in their services. Some of us like to worship in large groups, while others prefer the intimacy of just a couple of people gathered together. Some of us like to worship using colorful robes, incense, and bells, while others like very plain worship space in which to praise their Creator. It's not about who's right. It's about which helps you feel closest to God and ultimately helps you be the best child of God you can be. So, does God care which denomination we choose? No, I don't think so, not really. But if God were to give us advice on picking a church or denomination, my hunch is it would go something like this. First, steer clear of any denomination or church that talks about God's love being for them exclusively alone. Any faith that talks themselves up by talking someone else down is a non-starter and is inconsistent with the teachings of Christ. Hate is never a pathway leading to love. Number two, find some place you are comfortable, but not too comfortable. I've often had visitors say to me, I'm looking for a church that agrees with me on everything. And I think to myself, okay, how boring is that? So in their perfect church, services are not an opportunity for growth. They're simply a pep rally to feel good about themselves. They long to hear what they already believe in their church's teaching and preaching. If we all belong only to churches where we agree with everything, then eventually we will only have denominations with one person in each one. I do think God would tell us, if your church is not occasionally making you uncomfortable, then you probably aren't in the right place, or maybe you're not listening. Third, church is messy. Get used to it. It was even messy for Jesus. A number of years ago, I had a person who had attended our church for almost a year as a visitor approach me and say, well, I've decided to join your church. Wonderful, I said. I'm glad to hear it. Want to know why? Sure. I have visited countless other churches and left them all after a while because I discovered something that was common to them all. They were all filled with hypocrites. I have been looking for a church without hypocrites. You know, in thinking about what this person said to me, I've never found a church without hypocrites. And I think God would have me, instead of seeking a church filled with perfect people, looking for a church that will help me be a little less of a hypocrite myself. Fourth, hopefully you can tell by now, I'm a big fan of questions. When I was working in active church ministry, I loved teaching the class for newcomers. It was a kind of Christianity 101 course, and the best part of it was when people in class asked questions. I think God would have us look for a church that allows and even encourages questions. There's a moment I love in the musical 1776. The Continental Congress is debating about whether or not to even debate declaring independence. When the delegate from Rhode Island, Stephen Hopkins, is asked if he is for or against debating the question of independence, will he vote yea or nay? He says, "Well, in all my years, I ain't never heard, seen, nor smelled an issue that was so dangerous it couldn't be talked about. Hell yeah, I'm for debating anything. Rhode Island says yay." When I was at a parish in Kingsport, Tennessee, I would occasionally have a total stranger come for an appointment. They would have made the appointment because they had a question that they thought their own pastor would not tolerate being asked. So they set up an appointment to ask the question that was considered too dangerous to ask in their own parish. It always made me sad. Jesus always entertained questions. Sometimes the answers were uncomfortable, but pretty much Jesus' entire ministry was answering questions. I think God wants churches where questions are encouraged and never scolded with judgment. Finally, I think God would tell us to commit. If in your search for a church, you're looking for someplace you can go to consume whatever you want, make no relationships along the way, keep to yourself, and leave without any responsibility, we have places like that. Go visit the mall. Churches are not places to consume. They are places in which you participate. I'm reminded at this moment of the words JFK said in his inaugural speech, think not of what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Think what a remarkable place every place of faith, every church would be if everyone thought only in terms of how they can contribute to the community of which they were a part. You are a gifted and talented person. Share those gifts. We all can be giving of ourselves to our church, our worship community, or our spiritual group. And when we do, the community of which we are a part becomes stronger. And you know what? So do we. That's all for today. On your spiritual journey, may you ask questions, seek answers, and boldly go wherever the quest takes you. Please feel free to get in touch with me through email or Twitter. Just remember, both are SkyPilot with three T's, SkyPilotTTT. So my email is skypilot@gmail.com and Twitter is @SkyPilot. Thanks for listening to SkyPilot Faith Quest. I invite you to send me a question or leave a review. And remember, the sign of a strong faith, solid religion, or healthy spiritual journey is not certainty, but that you keep asking questions.